Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month. No commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. You coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
I've played many times, maybe like 15, but yeah, I have skipped a few times, and this time was natural to skip, although I should also preface it by saying that I never actually received an invitation, so. But in terms of like, okay, who's the strongest 15-year-old or whatever in history? I mean, two names obviously come to mind. I can think of my early games against Levon, and I would get a losing position from every game with Black, just losing, like straight from the opening. Move 10, move 15, just losing, and no time. That doesn't happen anymore. The same thing when I was playing Kramnik. I would basically just be lost in every opening with Black, and have no time on the clock against him.
Welcome back, everybody, to another C Squared podcast episode. It's been a while. In fact, it's been probably our longest break we've ever had on the podcast. I believe we're clocking in around 2 months right now that we haven't posted an episode. And that's a shame. But look, life gets in the way sometimes. And it's becoming a busy season. And it was definitely a busy end of the season in 2025 for you. Those were more or less the months that we missed. You played a lot of tournaments. I don't think we're going to cover all of them just because we have so many things to discuss at the beginning of the year, at the beginning of a very important year. In fact, the candidates are coming. There's so many things happening in the chess world, so many changes, so many stories, and we're going to try to cover some of them. But again, Fabi, happy 2026. I guess this is the first time we're chatting on camera in 2026, but of course we already saw each other in person as well, and we'll get to that perhaps later in the episode also. But first and foremost, what's up? How's it going? How's the beginning of the year treating you?
Yeah, it's well, so far I haven't really played any chess. I mean, you mentioned there were a lot of events, but so far this year I've been more in the watching mode than the playing mode. Which is good. So, you know, I had this busy period from freestyle, the finish of freestyle, which Levon won, and then the global chess league, which our team won, the Alpine SG Pipers unexpectedly mm-hmm. won, and then unexpectedly because some of us weren't in good form, but still we won the tournament, and then the World Rapid and Blitz, which Magnus won. And I got a medal, but felt like a bit of a bittersweet medal. And that's basically the roundup of the year. Obviously, the most significant event was the World and Rapid and Blitz Championship, right? Which was always is very, very interesting to play and to watch. One of my favorite events to play. I think also would be one of my favorite events to watch if I wasn't playing. And now there's obviously a very major event going on, the Tata Steel tournament in Vikenzee, traditional tournament going on, I don't know, 85 years or however long it's been. I actually have no idea.
The Wimbledon of chess. Yeah, that's how they call it.
That's how they call it. I don't actually see the similarities. It's not in England.
Well, it's always the Premier League of chess or the Wimbledon of chess. There's always something of chess.
It's a legendary tournament. You know, I've often like considered the parallel between tennis grand slams and chess tournaments, and which would be a grand slam in chess. Besides the obvious ones, like we have the World Championship, right? That's a bit of a different system. But like, what from the normal tournaments would be considered a grand slam in chess, right? That's, I don't know if there's an exact parallel between tennis and chess in terms of events, but I've asked myself this question. Maybe, you know, maybe you would say the Grand Chess Tour, maybe you'd say like Singfield Cup, mm-hmm. maybe you'd say Norway Chess, right?
The Singfield Cup.
Maybe you'd say Vikenzee. Those are all worthy candidates. But you don't have like four, like in tennis, you have like the four clear ones everyone's looking at, right? And then all the other important events. And in chess, it's like kind of everything is important and not at the same time. we have so many tournaments and it's hard to tell what's significant. Maybe to some people, the Rapid and Blitz will be super significant. To others, it won't. Maybe to some people, Tata Steel will be super significant. To others, it won't. You know, It's a bit less structured in that way, which is interesting.
Well, I feel the world championship cycle obviously is extremely important, and but you know, it's not comparable. I would say Vacanze is definitely one of those comparable events to the Grand Slam, just because of the history. Like, it's what, 85 years it's been going on. So it's a huge event. I think you played how many editions? Like 10?
Oh, more. Well, first I played
more than 10.
Yeah, when I first played, it wasn't even called Tata. It was called Chorus, because I was the steel company.
Chorus, yeah.
That was sponsoring the event. Then it got acquired by the Tata Group, right? Which
well, initially it was Vacanze, then it was Chorus, and now it's Tata Steel.
Like, originally
it has
three
names. Yeah,
town. It was in, I'm probably going to butcher the name, but Hugovins. Okay, Dutch people.
Hugovins, yeah. The mm-hmm. name, of course.
and then went to Vacanze, and so the first time I played in 2008, C Group. I have this like kind of rare distinction of, I don't know if I'm the only one, or maybe Magnus is also who has won all three groups, right? The C, the B, and the A. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if Magnus like won the C or just went directly to the B group. But that was, now it's impossible to catch that record because there is no C group. So it's kind of nice. And now that it's Challengers and Masters, and the C group when I played was strong, but it was, you know, it was strong for my level, right? At the time I was like around 2600. The Challengers is more like the B group now, and that's a very strong event, and the winner goes to the Masters. But the Masters group is of course a legitimate top, one of the, you know, all, I wouldn't say all, but many of the top players in the world. And it's enormously difficult to win. I've traditionally struggled a lot in Vacanze, despite like having some early successes at a young age and winning once with like a very good score with plus seven. I've also had like so many bad tournaments there. I don't know, when it goes bad there, mm-hmm. it goes really bad for me. It's not like 50% or something.
Minus
three and some nightmare tournaments.
I think it's just the nature of the tournament, right? It's a long tournament, 14 rounds, and then obviously the place where it's held, it's not the most sunny place in the world, especially not in January. And it can get depressing, especially if you're having a rough patch, a rough tournament. This is a candidate's year, and at least the last time, it was a candidate's year. You skipped it
as well.
You decided to skip this one.
Wait, did I?
2024. Oh, right. Yeah, you didn't play.
2024 did skip. Yeah,
we were in Miami. Yeah. We were. I remember because we were watching the tournament.
No, you're right. I've played many times. Maybe
it's almost
like 15,
started.
But yeah, I have skipped a few times, and this time was natural to skip. Although I should also preface it by saying that I never actually received an invitation, so. It's not like
okay.
I declined
so,
everything.
Okay. I didn't know that.
It's like my first time in forever that I wasn't invited, but I think they were going for very young.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month. No commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Scene. It's a really young tournament. And maybe I'm just too old by their standards.
Well, I think the oldest is Anish, right?
Yeah, but okay. Anish is...
Who will always get invited. Player, right? Like Anish will... Yeah. Yeah, he will always
after
that
tournament. Probably Fedos,
so I guess that makes sense. Should be,
but
should be.
I mean,
he's
not,
about what, 29?
I don't know, maybe a bit younger,
close to 30,
or maybe Bluebaum. I mean, they're both in their late 20s, I guess. But it's,
you know, Bluebaum is 28. I think Fedosev is a bit older than Bluebaum, but. Again, we're digressing.
Yeah, still very young guys.
In,
but the thing is, chess has become so young in general that Like Anish would be considered a veteran for sure, born in 94. And even these guys like for example, Fedosev, I think he reached like 2760 in, I don't know, 2017, 2018, one of those years. So it's been since he probably got like top 10 in the world almost nearly a decade ago. I mean, it's so he's a young guy by any standard, but by chess standards, he's kind of a semi-veteran. Even like Hans, we're not considering a young player anymore.
Okay. Hans is still young.
No, he's a young person.
Hans is like what, 20, 23,
yeah,
right?
23 is, it's no longer considered super young in chess, is it? It's like...
That's just because we have guys like Erdogan, yeah. Right? And Prague and the Indians that
Prague.
Kind of changed the narrative, changed the perspective.
Like 20, I
mean. Yeah, just... You saying that is kind of ridiculous.
Prague has played the Panthers.
You cannot Panthers. Say that.
How is this? This is no spring chicken anymore. I mean,
Prague is no spring chicken. Wait, just one second. I just wanna check if Prague is still listed as a junior.
Think so.
Okay, he's not listed as a junior
is the last,
anymore. Yeah,
the last of the juniors that we are used to. And then there's the new...
He's the last man standing.
like Erasmus.
You're right.
Andy's getting up there. Along with, I mean, Misha has been there for a while, but Andy's getting up there. Climbing, he's doing well.
He just made top 10. I see it. Top 10 juniors right now, 26-20.
Yeah.
Live, and he's only 15. Actually, he's the youngest after Erdogmus. In the top 10, Erdogmus only 14 years of age. I would say probably he's the story of the town in Tatasteel and in the chess world in general. I mean, the guy is just absolutely monstrous. He was called the probably the best 14 years old that ever lived and played by Magnus. What's your take on that? Do you think he's more or less accurate?
I mean, it is kind of incredible how comfortable he is competing with top players at this age. I mean, it's you could call it an up and down tournament, but it really feels like an up tournament for him because although he had a few accidents. I mean, to be on a plus score in a top tournament at the age of 14, competing on totally equal terms. With so many of these established guys, you know, we could say young but established, like Arjun, like Vincent. He beat Arjun. You know, was a moment away from beating Gukesh. Of course, it felt a bit accidental because he didn't see it in advance. Neither did Gukesh. They both blundered it. It would have been a bit of an accidental win, but still, you know, he's plus one, and that's a very good score. And he beat Maxim in a match recently. I mean, Maxim is one of the true greats of our generation, 2800 plus player, world blitz champion. He beat him in a match. That's pretty, without losing a game, that's pretty tremendous as well. So yeah, it's, you know, when I look at like the kind of exceptional junior talents, like Andy, for example, like Mishra, these are exceptional talents, guys who have every chance of being top players. Somehow, like Erdogmus is still quite a bit higher rated than them, which is remarkable.
He's almost 2700.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. Of course,
2684, 15 rating points.
I suspect there will be some like minor correction. I mean, he'll continue his upward trajectory, but there's always some like minor corrections here and there. That's totally normal, right? You see these young guys, they make a big push, then they stabilize a bit, lose a bit of rating, perhaps. Then they make another big push. It's ever like a straight line upwards. He's still very young. He's still very inexperienced. Has a lot to learn, but still he's playing at a 2700 level. You know, by the numbers, by the games as well. And I mean, of course, he's going to be a top player. It would be ridiculous if he doesn't become an absolute top player.
Yeah, and his stringing performances also in Rapid and Blitz, right? He did quite well in the World Rapid and Blitz. I think that that was kind of the trigger that pushed Magnus into saying,
World Rapid, he did well,
giving him such praise.
World Blitz, I don't remember.
Yeah, he did really well. He did really well.
Yeah, I mean, to be good in, because younger players are usually not quite as good in Rapid and Blitz. For whatever reason. I mean, it just is how it is. But that's typically how it is. And so that he was so good in Rapid Blitz, I don't really remember how he did, but in Rapid he was near the top of the standings for a large portion of it. So very impressive player for sure. We'll definitely be seeing him.
Yeah, I feel he's one of those guys that you kind of see him pop up on the scene and you understand very, very quickly that he has all the ingredients to make it to the top, and it's going to be very difficult to not see him at the top. Not only that he's playing the way he's playing, but also he has the support system, right? Which I think is quite crucial. I don't think he's going to school. I would be completely shocked if he's not only focused on chess. He has an incredible coach. He's working with Mamed Yarov for quite a while in Turkey. So the support system is there. I think he's also financially supported by quite a wealthy person in Turkey, from what I'm hearing. So obviously all the ingredients are there for him to just focus on his training and his performance. And psychologically, just seeing him dominate some of these guys and being able to fight toe-to-toe and you know, saying in interviews that he doesn't fear anybody, you can feel that. And you know, these type of words are not something that every single 14-year-old will say. There's a lot of, you know, humility and humbleness whenever you speak with most 14-year-olds, and not to say that he doesn't exhibit those things, but he's not afraid of anybody, and you can sense that. So which is a good thing in my book. I think he's definitely onto something, and we're going to see him for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, like, my general take on it is that I don't know the circumstances of most players, right? I don't know their money situation. I don't know their support system in general. But if you look at the numbers, it usually doesn't lead you too astray. In terms of, like, okay, who's the strongest 15-year-old or whatever in history? I mean, two names obviously come to mind in terms of when we have, like, the very modern period. Of course, you can look at Magnus when... actually, three names definitely come to mind. I mean, it should be Magnus, Alireza, and Wade. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably the three youngest to get to 2700, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay, you can also go back and look historically, but it's a bit harder when, I mean, like, obviously Gary was an exceptional prodigy when he was young, right? For example, Fischer, but okay, it's a bit harder to measure. Now we have these rating systems that are updated every month. It's very convenient to look at rating progress. So like Wei Yi, I think, was 2715, Alireza same. And Matt, although I think Alireza maybe a bit later, not 100% sure.
Wei was the youngest 2700 ever. Yes. I know that. I don't know exactly when he hit it, but I know he was the youngest when
Magnus
he
Magnus is also up there. When did I become 2700? I'm trying to think. So I think it was 2010.
I was just about to ask you that.
I'm pretty sure it was 2010, and it was before my 18th birthday. So I think I was 17. I was on the cusp.
That's
of
not
18.
Bad.
And I remember, like, some tournaments where I was very, very close and, like, basically touching it in some tournaments and look, because of course it's a number you look at that age when you're when you're close to it. And I think that's a bit more usual if we look at maybe, like, I don't know, Vincent, for example, right? Probably, or I don't know, just some random Maxime or Anish, we probably see around that, like, 16 to 18 age. You'll see usually people starting to get close. To get close at 14, 15, mm-hmm. or to make it at 15, is quite a bit more unusual.
Yeah, I saw a graph, I think, on Reddit. Somebody posted it, and he was a huge outlier. I think the closest one was Wei, obviously, as we talked. And his graph was somewhat sad because at some point, immediately after hitting it, he sort of quit, right?
Wait, when did Wei ever quit?
He didn't quit, right? But he kind of stabilized around there, and he didn't push past that. And then COVID came, which completely sidelined him.
COVID was obviously tough for Chinese players. I mean, for everyone, but for Chinese players, because the measures in China.
Like Wei was the guy that everybody thought that he's going to make it. He never.
Yeah, I'm looking at his graph.
He never made a huge push.
So, okay, he's born
after that.
In 99, he hit 2700 March of 2015. So yeah, I guess he was 15 and a bit at that point. And then he continued up until 2737. And then, he did have a plateau and hovered around the 2730 to 2750 range until now. Which, fair enough. I mean, 2750 is a top player.
It's not bad.
Nothing to be ashamed of.
It's not bad. What do you see as his strengths and perhaps weaknesses as well, if you want to touch on that?
What are we talking about?
No, Erdogmus. Wei, we talked about quite a lot. Erdogmus right now. From the small sample of big events that he's played so far.
I mean, okay, like I follow his games in Vikings A, but can I say that I watched his match against Maxime. Can I tell you that I have great insight based on the maybe two dozen or so games I've seen of his?
Better than most.
I saw him also play in I think one of the advantages that young players have now compared to my generation, when we were, in that age group, even if we were not at his level, what made it difficult to compete with top players was that you couldn't really breach the opening knowledge gap. It was just too much work and too much experience. And we didn't have analytical tools to do it. It took years of work and experience to get there. So if you're 15, and even if you can calculate well and you can do this well and that well, you basically just get screwed out of the opening against top players. Like I can think of my early games against Levon. People can check them. I first played Levon in 2008. And then we started to play very regularly at a similar rating around 2012, when we were both around high 2700s to 2800. And I would get a losing position from every game with black, just losing, like straight from the opening, move 10, move 15, just losing and no time. So that went on for a few years. That doesn't happen anymore. The same thing when I was playing Kramnik, even though I have a very good score against Kramnik, I would basically just be lost in every opening with black and have no time on the clock against him. And so that was normal. You get a losing position against players who are much better prepared. And then you try to fight on and try to survive. And that was just the state of the game back then. Now it's impossible if you work on chess to get a losing position. You can get maybe a position you're uncomfortable with stylistically, or a position where you're a little bit worse. Even that usually doesn't happen if you're well prepared. Just look at the openings in Vikings A. White does not really have a clear theoretical edge. Sometimes people take extreme risks with black to create chances because it's relatively easy to equalize. If you want to like be creative and mixed up, you can also take, like Anish did against Bluebaum, actually worked out theoretically, but then he made some mistakes. That's a big difference. That allows these young players to compete on more equal terms. Because they don't have to deal with getting losing positions from the opening. They have like more or less a balanced situation at the start of the game. And then, because they calculate well, that area is still pretty even. Like calculation, I think Erdogmus is probably not much worse than anyone else. I mean, maybe a tiny bit worse, but you have one of these kids who's like very tactically sharp and trained to calculate. Why would he be worse than, for example, than Wesley or Anish at calculation?
Do you feel like so what are that what also are plays into their confidence level? The fact that you know, this gap in opening preparation has basically shrunk completely? Like, did you feel whenever you were playing were you afraid of the opening stage, let's say?
Well, what was to be afraid of? I mean, I just knew I would get a losing position. Like, there's nothing to be afraid of. I could prepare all day and all night, but I knew that against Levon, I would get in serious trouble with black, and against Kramnik, I would get in serious trouble with black. And the thing is, you could very often just prepare a losing line. Like, I was playing the Grunfeld back then at the top level, and I very often prepared losing variations, like literally just losing. Looking back on it now. So it's just a totally different world. I mean, they don't even imagine that they can be losing, because they analyze openings, and all the numbers that they see are like 0.2 to zeros. I mean, you don't get worse with black unless you just miss something in your repertoire, or you're trying to experiment, and then it can go wrong. But a lot of these players have a repertoire, and they don't get in trouble. That's the state of the game. I mean, how games are decided is never in the opening now. It just, maybe once in a blue moon, but basically, like, look and Viking say, you know, okay, Arvin beat Tai Daivon because of a random time scramble blunder in endgame, not based on the opening. Gukesh won against Erdogmas, opening was dead equal. Anish equalized with some random bullshit, was even slightly better than lost in calculation. I mean, games are not decided in the opening. Back then, more often than they did. So that's just how it is. Of course, it does feel nicer to start on a level footing from the start of the game. But if you think about, like, let's say I was playing Vichy 14 years ago. I mean, I was. And the guy had just finished preparing for a world championship match, and he spent like 3 months on preparation. It's very hard to be able to match his level of opening knowledge and preparation. I'm working with one coach. We have very limited resources in general. You know, you're working with, mm-hmm, with a desktop, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe a laptop. You have four cores. Now people plug into a cloud and they instantly have a supercomputer, basically. And everyone has the same engines and everything. So there was like this big story when the Topalov, who was Topalov playing against? I guess it was Vichy. I guess it was a Topalov-Vichy match in 2010. And then it was revealed that like Topalov had this crazy supercomputer. I don't remember how many cores they said. Something ridiculous, 64 cores. Oh my God. That he has this monster. And it was so scary. And people were like, wow. I mean, Topalov has this absolute monster. What's gonna happen to Vichy? And then the first game Vichy plays the Grunfeld, doesn't survive the opening, never touches the Grunfeld again in his life. I mean, it's just a different world. Like, what, you know, okay, Vichy did win that match. Well, yeah, that's a different story.
Yeah, no, completely. Yeah, it's a new world for sure. Actually, because you touched on this subject, how much do you think world championship / candidates preparation survives nowadays? Like you said, all of these guys that went, like you, after you went through the world championship match, I would assume you felt quite good about your opening understanding for a while. Magnus, every single time he played a world championship, it felt like the next year he was coming back scoring much better because of that residual opening preparation that he was getting. Do you feel like that more or less has, you know, shrunk the shelf life of opening preparation? The fact that nowadays you can go through an opening, you can analyze an opening so much faster and so much better?
Yeah, actually, I think it's a huge difference now. Like, okay, I can talk about my match against Magnus, where he prepared the Sveshnikov. And I can also talk about my preparation after and how it helped me. But like, if we just look at Magnus specifically, his like knowledge of the Rosalie mode Sveshnikov and his understanding of the opening was so tremendous and helped him I mean, he won so many games in 2019 in the Rose-Limo and Sveshnikov and this general complex. And the fact that we pushed him quite hard in it, I think was also helpful to him. Because, you know, he got a really strong test of it, and it was good for his confidence in the opening. Then when he prepared, for example, the Catalan against Napomniachtchi, and you can look at his games for like the next 2 years after that, he collected so many wins in the Catalan, and they really did accumulate, and they came up with and accumulated a large body of ideas. I think maybe Dubal, I don't know exactly how it went in the team. Maybe Dubal was the main analyst in the Catalan, that's just speculation. I do know that he was like one of the main guys behind the Sveshnikov. But in terms of the Catalan, I mean, they really did a good job there, and Magnus collected for like 1-2 years after that. I don't think he views the opening so fondly anymore, because there are so many solutions now. A lot of the ideas they were developed, they were tried, they either worked or didn't, but they're kind of known now. But for example, like he beat Anish in Vikingsay in this idea. He beat Mamed Yarov in Vikingsay in this idea. Like, and then after the game, Mamed said like this is one of the best games he's ever seen, and I think people underestimate just how much. Well, first of all, they did a good job, and Magnus also showed a tremendous understanding of the openings. But to have these kind of systematic weapons that were really helpful for him, I think, and that he knew well and that he had worked on a lot and probably played a ton of practice games. And then he tested out at the very strictest level, the World Championship match against a prepared opponent. This level of work was very helpful for his openings, for sure. Now let's think about Gukesh, because Gukesh worked a lot for the match. He won the match. And then if you're involved in chess work and opening work regularly, you can see the residual ideas that he throws out now and then. And the truth is that they're not quite as effective. I mean, it's probably just a sign of the times. Like, if Gukesh prepared only the Catalan, he would probably run out of ideas like halfway through the match, because just antidotes would be found very quickly. So his approach was more like a bit of a hit and run. But the thing about Gukesh's ideas is that they're not like very, very targeted for places where your opponent has like a series of like a narrow path to safety. What he more goes for is like a type of like an idea, and then it's just a game, right? There's a lot of moves for both sides, and it's very hard to neutralize. Like, you can't kill the game with the black pieces if you're facing him, but he also can't really analyze it to like some sort of advantage anywhere. So he comes to the board with this idea. It's good for getting a game, but it's not super threatening. Like, you don't feel. And I faced a few of his ideas, like last round of Bucharest. It's relatively well analyzed, puts a bit of pressure. He's playing fast, but you don't feel like the position is dangerous, right? You don't feel like you're walking a tightrope. And that's a bit of a difference. I think for me, the most effective ideas are the ones where you find that your opponent has to walk a tightrope. And then they get to safety at the end of it. And then probably if they get to safety, then you're not going to win the game anymore. Like, classic example would be my game against Maxime from Canada.
The Nidorf.
He actually walked the tightrope, basically, from safety. And then perhaps this kind of stress of going through all the lines tired him out, and he made, right at the finish point, basically, when he was already safe, he just made a mistake and then got into renewed trouble. But that's a classic kind of, basically putting maximum pressure on. And you know that if your opponent finds all the moves, they're going to survive. It's not really, I'm not trying to get a game. Like, I'm not trying to play a game in that line. I'm just trying to kill my opponent from the start. It's a different approach.
Speaking of candidates, now that we kind of got into that World Championship cycle discussion and the candidates, there's a bunch of them that are playing in Tata. And I'm sure you've been keeping tabs on them. Let's take them one by one, or perhaps pile them on as a group. Which one of them feels like the most impressive so far? We have four of them: Prague, Sindarov. Obviously, Sindarov is doing quite well. Giri, and of course, Blue Bomb, who is somewhat of a sensation of Tata Steel after a shaky start. Scored quite a few important victories, some of them against, one of them against Giri, the other one against Gukesh, and I think I'm missing one, but I cannot remember exactly which one it was.
Well, there's four candidates, yes. Right? Half the candidates field is here.
Yes.
Sindarov, Blue Bomb, Prague, and Anish. And they, two of them, each pair has the same score. Just probably maybe not the pair you'd expect, right? Anish and Prague are on both on minus.
I thought they were on 50%.
Minus one, yeah, each.
I think you're right. They're on minus.
No. Prague has lost two games, then a lot of draws. Then he won against Aravind, relatively good game. Then so, but he didn't really fix his very poor start of two losses. I mean, he recovered in the sense that he hasn't lost again, but still, minus one is probably not too thrilling for him. And Anish is a bit more rocky. I mean, he had those two losses then, but then he won two games in the middle of the tournament against Gukesh and Noderbeck. But then he lost this very poor game, I have to say, very poor game against Blue Bomb. I mean, to lose a totally normal position in like three moves, I mean, getting your queen trapped, not great. And Blue Bomb could have maybe even won more games he certainly could have won more games than he did.
He's
plus two. Great score, but he was also like completely crushing Arjun. I mean, that he didn't win that was very surprising. Also, he was completely crushing Tai Daiban, completely crushing from the opening. He could have won those two games.
He's playing well. He's showing that he's a candidate. I mean, you know, we've had the dark horses in each candidates. I can remember Alexenko. I think Alexenko. Was it Alexenko or am I? Yes, Alexenko
played in 2020.
And then, of course, who am I missing? Abasov. Oh my God!
You mean Abasov? Or
of course, Abasov. But Abasov already going into the candidates, we kind of knew that his level is dropping after the World Cup, which qualified him. Blue Bomb, his level is not dropping at all. Right now, his level is increasing. It seems like he's hitting his stride. I think he's touching 2,700 in live ratings for the first time. Obviously, he's feeling himself right now.
I mean, okay, not really a hot take, but honestly, I don't think that any of the tournaments going up to candidates really matter at all in terms of the candidates. I mean, you know, Blue Bomb is obviously a very good player. He can win. He can beat top players. You know, there is obviously a theoretical chance he can win candidates. Same that, like, you know, Anish or Prague, two of the on-rating favorites, can crash and burn in candidates, right? But the fact that they're not showing anything in Vikings A, and Blue Bomb and Sindarov are showing a very good score, I don't really think it means that. I don't think it has any like relevance towards the candidates. Besides, they're strong, they're capable players. You know, we knew that before. I mean, okay, if they were losing all their games, and they're also underdogs, then we'd probably say, yeah, it's maybe not looking very good. I mean, Sindarov in general seems like basically a top
for
player
sure
to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, not a huge surprise to me that he's plus two. That Blue Bomb is plus two, it's probably a bit of a surprise. I mean, it's also not like a crazy surprise to me. I don't know. I don't really see.
Does the minus
see
one
as a shock
of Giri and Brock surprise you a little bit?
No, also not. No. For a few reasons. First of all, I think because it's just a very tough tournament, and basically, if you a few things go wrong if some of your, like, let's say you take some calculated risks, because you don't want to just like draw all your games to infinity. Like, you're trying to win the tournament, right? Let's say Anish and Prag, they've both won this tournament before. They're both top players. They want to win this tournament. Some of the other guys, for example, or Dogmas, it's his first time. He's probably just happy with like a, I mean, it's totally normal that he's probably happy with like a solid performance. If you told him before that he scores like 50%, he'd probably think, yeah, that's a good performance. Now, okay, maybe that he's on a plus score, he's getting more ambitious, but it's a bit of a different mentality for sure if you've been there and won the tournament. And so let's say you have a guy like Anish, he doesn't want to draw his games to infinity. He takes a few risks, they backfire. It happens all the time. Then you have a guy who is slightly less ambitious at the start. But he's still very capable, picks up a few wins, suddenly gets ambitious. I mean, also normal thing. Now, in terms of like who will win the tournament, I still think like there's only three more games. So it is actually close to the finish line. And Noderbeck is half a point ahead. Like I would think that like between Noderbeck and Javakir, they probably, between the two of them, they probably take around like 80% of the equity in the tournament.
I'll throw in Van Forest. I feel Van Forest is having a very, very good event. He's won this tournament before. He knows what it takes, and he's playing really well. He's showing some cool ideas also in the opening. So Jordan is doing great.
Like, Jordan's a very... like, people don't quite realize, but Jordan's a very, very gifted player. I mean, he just has these like, like blunders sometimes that really they really take away. If you're having like random blunders, they can really take away from your results. But at his best, I mean, he's very, very strong. His finish is like, okay, he's white against Noderbeck in the next round, so he should probably win that game, because otherwise, it's going to be very hard to catch him. His last two rounds are Arjun and Prague. Of course, can win those games, but can also just draw the rest of his games.
Yeah.
Sindarov, well, probably, I mean, he has two blacks. He might be forced to take some risks in the last round against Taidaivon.
But Taidaivon, he's really struggling in this event, right? He's at the bottom of the standings, three points. His openings are great.
But his openings are good. I mean, okay, he's struggling a lot. He's a well-prepared player, but I mean, it's like last game, crazy. Like how did he lose to Arvind? He's a piece up in the end game. I mean, he had no time, but still, that was to lose it is crazy.
Yeah.
Now,
who does he have? He has Jordan, Bluebaum, and...
He has Jordan, he has Bluebaum. Yeah, it's also interesting. I mean... I don't think anyone with lower score than 6 points is going to win. Like, I don't think Hans has he's not going to make up a 1 point gap with three rounds to go. It's unless he just like, you know, wins 2.5 out of his last three. And probably also that would only be enough for a tie at best.
Gukesh, Anish,
but
okay, it's not easy. And
he has two blacks. I mean,
and Taidaivon. Okay. Okay.
So I just think that it's most likely Noderbeck. I mean, Noderbeck has had this like issue for a while, which has actually cost him a lot of tournaments, which is that he's doing great. And then like the last round, he loses.
He lost against Jordan when Anish won Tata Steel. I think it was 2022, 2023.
Yeah, that's one example. But also like the Ustchess Masters, he lost to, I think it was Prague last year. I mean... Vikan Zay, I think on two different occasions, like he also lost to Arjun last year in the penultimate round. I mean, very crucial games. There's a lot of examples of this. So hopefully he solves that issue, because it's kind of a serious issue, right? These last round games, you know, when you have like a half point ahead of the field, you can't really afford to lose any games.
Yeah, not even sometimes you have to win the games, right? Interesting character,
but still, I definitely bet on him winning this tournament, or Sindarov. I could also see Sindarov winning this. I don't know. I don't see I mean, Blue Bomb, it's hard to say because he's playing Fiddlesave, and Fiddlesave is a bit of a wild card too. Like, Fiddlesave can play amazing, and he can also have a poor day. He's playing her Dogmas in the last round. I don't know if that's a target, though. I don't know if her Dogmas is a target whatsoever. So it's not like there's any easy opponents. I mean, I look at all their remaining games. I don't see any like, there's no guarantees. I mean, Noderbeck is playing Blue Bomb in the penultimate round. Maybe that's like, he has the white pieces. You know, he can definitely try to put pressure.
One kind of constant. In at least up until this moment, regarding Blue Bomb, it seems like a lot of players are taking. I can think of the game against Anish. I can think of the game against Indarov. He did win that game. Yes.
Well, Sindarov,
Sindarov did take ridiculous risks. Everybody seems to be
risks with
okay. I don't want to sound disrespectful, but targeting Blue Bomb, which gives him chances in return. Yeah, that's why he's also scoring so well.
Yeah. Yeah. In hindsight, obviously, poor decision on most of the players' part. I mean, this game, which surprises me, is the one Gukesh against Blue Bomb, because like basically you're white and straight out of your preparation in a line that, because Blue Bomb is playing Petrov in the throughout the tournament, so like straight out of your preparation in a line that you probably semi-anticipated, and judging by the time spent, like, you know, Gukesh up to basically bishop f5 took him out of his prep, but after bishop f5 he basically, like, within five moves goes straight to a strategically lost position, which is just shocking. I mean, you go to this obstacle of bishops, the bishop is on c2, and then you play b3. I mean, like, what have you done to your poor bishop? And I don't know if this bishop ever escaped in the game, but probably not. Yeah, never really escaped. Just like this kind of was shocking. I can see this happening and like blitz, but in a classical game to get to such a strategically lost position with white was a surprise. I mean, this game between Blue Bomb and Anish, I can understand much more. Like, because, of course, it was a pretty careless mistake, but these kind of tactical mistakes, like, you know, I guess just missing knight g2 entirely. Like, maybe he thought rook e1. Sorry, not rook e1. Maybe he thought queen e1, like trying to trade queens or something. I don't know. But maybe he missed rook f3. Or maybe he missed bishop b2. But, like, one of these moves is possible to miss.
Yeah.
We would have to ask him exactly what he missed. But these kind of tactical mistakes, okay, you know, maybe he should have instinctively felt like in the center, queen a bit restricted, that there could be some danger here. But like the way that Gukesh drifted into this lost position was far less easy for me to understand.
What's happening with Gukesh? Obviously, you know, the world champion, extra pressure comes along with that. It's not an easy event, especially if you're not feeling great throughout the event very long, and you can easily lose a lot of games. But remember that game against Noderbeck? I mean, that was probably the biggest blunder I've seen from a top player in years. I don't know. I don't want to say in the last 10 years, but that was a huge, huge blunder.
I think he must take on e5. He goes rook g5 and look at Noderbeck there. And look at Gukesh. He can't believe he's just blundered queen takes f6. Takes the pawn. And can you believe what just happened? The rook is hanging for free. He just blundered everything. Noderbeck shakes his head. Gukesh resigns.
What do you think is
classical chess?
How would you read that?
For sure.
Yeah, in classical chess. I mean, classical chess with time. I mean, sure, he was falling behind on the clock, perhaps, you know, going in the last few minutes, but he still had time. There was not that urgent last few seconds time trouble situation. He had time. He spent about 2 minutes, I think, on his decision, and he basically resigned on the spot, blunder rook in one move. What just happened there? How do you read that episode?
I mean, it's like, yeah, in some ways, I guess, kind of interesting. In some ways, the least interesting thing. I mean, there's nothing to, like, he missed queen f6. I mean, he thought e f6, queen f6, and I guess evaluated it as kind of equal. I mean, just missed queen f6. Like, how it happens, I don't know. Of course, shocking blunders happen. It's just visualization, right? He just didn't see that queen f6 as a possible move. You know, like, I don't really know. Like, what causes it? This is probably some neurological question, which, like, what causes a kind of lapse of pattern recognition that like you instantly see queen f6, or you don't see it somehow. I mean, this is probably something that's more in terms of how the brain works, right? Because it can happen. Like, chess blindness happens in different ways at different times. Just usually doesn't happen like this. But, you know, I've put pieces on pre, like against Anish. It was this kind of time travel phase, but basically I just put a rook where a knight was defending that square. Like, how do you explain
generally,
that?
Generally, I attribute that to wear and tear. But the guy is only 19. Like, I can see that happening from a guy in his, let's say, mid-30s. You know, it doesn't matter that you're 2750, 2800. I can see that happening from wear and tear. Just nervous system getting damaged throughout the years. But, you know, Gukesh is only 19. These things shouldn't happen.
I don't think it has anything to do with that. I just think that like chess blindness can kind of hit you at any moment. And some people are less susceptible to it than others. We can speculate on who's more susceptible, who's less susceptible. But definitely some people are very good at avoiding blunders. Now, this rarely happens to Gukesh. Maybe it happens 1 in 100 times, and maybe to someone else, like, I don't know, to Vincent, it happens 0 out of 100 times.
I don't know. I guess Fedosev is the closest in this event that it happened.
That's a different game. Type of blunder, because, like, that's more like a 2-3 move thing.
Yeah.
And that feels more like kind of losing concentration. This one I wouldn't even say is losing concentration. This is just like accident striking. But of course, accidents can be costly. So it was a very costly accident. Now, I've made like blunders that just happen to be not so significant. It happens sometimes. Like, you just miss something super obvious. It could be super crucial, but just luckily it's not that crucial. That also happens. And those stay behind the scenes because you nobody sees them, right? They don't actually affect the game. They could be, first of all, they could be in your calculations, or you just miss something and then luckily you have a tactic that kind of saves the day. That happens. And then nobody notices because they think, oh, well, of course you just saw the tactic.
He's a genius. Yeah.
Oh, maybe not genius. Maybe it's super simple, but they think you can calculate two moves. And it turns out that you can't even calculate one. You just got lucky. also happens. So this one just happened to be kind of dramatic, especially in its presentation, because it just gives a rook and a pawn with check in one move.
It's so it's brutal.
In some ways, not a very interesting moment, but perhaps also how it happens, why it happens, could also be interesting to think about.
One of the reasons we missed the last, let's say, couple of months is also because you started preparation for the candidates that obviously is coming in a few months. How would you assess the first camp? We have just finished a camp. How would you assess the first camp? How would you assess the work? What does the preparation entails for such a big event without giving too much detail that can be used against you?
It's like a police. You're under no obligation to say anything that may incriminate you.
Exactly. Are you happy with the work?
In general, I think it's interesting to prepare for a big goal. So I like that. The candidates is kind of the big one that comes around every 2 years. Not everyone has a chance to play it. I've played it many times in a row. If you win the candidates and win the match, then you're in an even luckier position. You don't have to play it. But that's only one person who gets there. So I always find it interesting work, and I think it's helpful to be able to do it. Because, you know, if you have no goals, if you have nothing to work towards, then of course you can lose your motivation for sure. And the truth is that everyone is going to go through this process in the tournament. Some will have longer training, some will have shorter training, some will have more intense, less intense. For some it'll be the first time, for many, in fact. How many? Blue Bomb, Yesipenko, Sidarov. Is that it?
I guess that might be it. Yeah, Anish Prag already played.
Anish Prag, Hikaru, myself.
Hikaru, you.
And no, Wei also first time. So it's okay. Half have are playing for first time, and half are veterans in a sense, including Prag. As we already said, he's a veteran. So it'll be interesting for them also for their first time to prepare for such a big goal.
And I would assume it's also, you know, the aspect of creating somewhat of a new team, right? A new team to prepare for this type of goal.
They probably have people they've been worked with. I mean,
I think at some point he mentioned that he didn't have anybody that he was working with. I don't think I'm confusing him with somebody else. I think he was the one that said that.
I mean, I would guess that he doesn't have a main trainer, but he probably is friendly and works with the other German top players, maybe with the exception of Vincent, but probably like guys like Kollars, for example. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he has a team that's kind of made up with a few of the German guys, or maybe two of the German guys. I mean, you don't need a huge team. Maybe it's two other guys and him. Sindarov has the people that he works with. Wei, I actually don't know who he works with. I mean, I'm sure he does work with some people, but in general, the Chinese players, they
band together. Yeah.
Well, they also, like, who they work with is very often not super public.
Yes.
And Hikaru has already, Hikaru, Anish, like their experience in this. Prague also has been a top player for a few years and is kind of experienced in this matters.
Should be interesting.
It will be interesting for sure.
No. Should be interesting. Lastly, and maybe we'll touch more next episode on this freestyle chess partners with FIDE. Now the Freestyle World Championship is going to happen in Waisenhaus in just a couple of weeks. Notoriously, Hikaru is not going to be playing. He refused the invitation, saying that he has better things to do or more important things to worry about, namely the candidates, and he doesn't feel that this is a legit world championship. Wesley expressed similar feelings, I guess. What's your take on that? You are playing that, so I would assume you're quite happy with the world championship branding, but what's your take on this new 2026 freestyle cycle in partnership with FIDE?
Well, yeah, in some ways it's good that they reached some kind of agreement. In the other sense, I mean, the winner of this tournament will be the world champion, right? They'll say they're the world champion. Everyone will say they're the world champion. The winner of the final in South Africa, which Levon won, Levon is not the world champion, despite him winning that. The winner of the tour, who was announced, Magnus, he's not the world champion. Like, let's just assume it's not one of them, right? If it's someone else. Mm-hmm. If it's one of them, then obviously. So why is the winner of the last event, which was the final and had double the prize fund, and basically the same players and the same format, or even like even a longer format, why is that not the world champion, but this is? Like, why is Magnus, who won the tour, not the world champion? Like, this question, I mean, besides the fact that just because it is, that's when they struck the agreement. There's no like good reason in my view for why they that's when they negotiated it and that's when it happened. And the winner will be able to say they're the world champion. But also in my view, there's never been a legitimate freestyle or Fischer Random or Chess 960 World Championship. So
now, go ahead, finish your.
I mean, there was the previous one, 2022, which Hikaru won, with some odd random online qualifiers before. Maybe I've spoken about it before, but like the first time I played one of the qualifiers on chess.com, it was like very inconvenient because it was during another tournament. And so like basically the first kind of like three rounds, I think I scored half a point and Hikaru also scored like half a point because we both lost to the same 2000 players, like literal beginners who immediately got banned. And so after this, and then I just left the tournament, and then I decided, okay, screw it. I'm not going to play any of the other qualifying events. Like, why should I go through this process? I mean, if they're just going to allow like the most blatant cheaters ever. Hmm. So, I mean, other people tried and Hikaru eventually qualified through a qualifier, which I think ended up being like probably clean, right? I mean, one of the Lee Chess ones, ended up being much cleaner because it was a match system. It was on camera, but these chess.com events, which weren't on camera, they were like complete. And the fact that you have like any cheating going on in a world championship qualifier, in my view, already completely invalidates entirely, like the whole thing, because the fact that probably a significant amount of players just decided not to play. And then they also, half the field in Reykjavik was just pre-invited. Like, okay, they invited Magnus because he's the number one in the world. And they invited Wesley because he was the previous world champion from 2019. Of course, they have like this world championship any arbitrary amount of years, like every 4 years, every 8 years, every 3 years, whatever it is. Which is also completely, I mean, the fact that like you can be world champion in 22 and then stay world champion indefinitely because they never organized another one also invalidates it. Then they invited a local player, Icelandic grandmaster who is like probably 25-50 or so. Mm-hmm. Like that, I mean, also I understand if you invite the previous world champion to a round robin, but you invite just someone, a local player, like you can't invite a local player to world championship. And then I think they invited Jan Nepomniachtchi directly because he was the runner-up of their last world championship match. But it's not a classical world champ. It's a Fischer Random. So how are you inviting two players from the classical cycle? And then half the field is already filled up from invites, including the local player. And then they call this a legitimate world championship. Like, okay, so to me, the previous one, the 2019 one, at least, okay, it had online qualifiers, but at least they put some in-person proctors in place. And at least there were no invited players. Except Magnus, of course, because I guess Magnus is always invited. Which is also kind of silly, like just because you're... But I understand he's a world champion. He's the number one in the world. He doesn't have to qualify. But still, in some sense, it's not a democratic process that you have a player who just qualifies to the final of the world championship because...
I would have invited Wesley just because he's the world champion before Hikaru, who Hikaru sort of declined.
In 2019?
Yes.
I mean,
while back. But I would be like, okay, look,
to win the world championship.
Hikaru doesn't want it. I'll invite Wesley.
But it's 7 years ago.
The last world champion.
It's 7 years ago. I mean, come on. Like I understand. I mean, Wesley, like his performance there was tremendous. He beat Magnus.
Yes.
He beat.
He says
Jan.
That's why they're not inviting him anymore because he beat Magnus.
I don't think so at all. But also, it's 7 years ago. I mean, if you think about it, that's an ocean of time.
Yeah.
And also, if you think about it, I mean, this is freestyle. It's not Fischer Random. It's a totally different thing.
Right.
I think we got rid of the difference is that there's one less position. Like the king and queen switched, I don't think we play with. Although I'm not 100% sure on that.
There's actually a difference?
Yeah, like the king and queen. Right. Like the king being on D1 and the queen on E1. I'm not sure if we have that position currently. Like if we just get rid of it.
Hmm. Yeah, I had no idea that there's an actual difference.
I don't know. I
thought it was just a name.
I think we had this discussion at one of the early freestyle events when it was like called the Go Challenge. It was like, are we playing with the king on D1 and queen on E1 if we get that position? Or are we also just taking that out of the lottery, out of the mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. you know, random draw? But the thing is, like, the king on d1, queen on e1 changes things dramatically because it changes the castling. So it's actually a very different position than the starting position. It's not a mirror. But anyway, that's my view on freestyle. Like, there is, you know, the person who wins this one can say they're the world champion. Hikaru can say they're the world champion. Wesley can say they're the world champion. But none of these...
And hopefully the next world championship is going to happen next year.
I mean, actually, I think that Wesley can say, okay, it was a totally, totally normal cycle that led up to that world championship. But the last one, I had so many issues with it at the time. I mean, I already laid them out, so I don't have to rehash that. But
all right, Fabi. With that being said, I think it's a great place to let it go and focus on the last three rounds of Tata Steel. I'm sure you'll be following all the games closely, and then probably we're going to reconnect with another highlight episode after that one is over. Great chatting with you, and hope you guys missed us but are not super unhappy about us being on for a couple of months. Nevertheless, we're planning on doing a bit more regularly, obviously, these episodes, and it's great to be back. So until the next one, hope you guys enjoyed this one. Don't forget, like, subscribe, and all the good stuff. We're trying to rebuild the momentum with the algorithm as well. So help us with that. That's the easiest way for you guys to help our journey. Anyway, see you guys in the next episode. And Fabi, until next time. Cheers.